Welcome to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have as my guest today Michael Redhill, and we will be discussing Constellation, his new novel published by Little Brown. And first of all, Michael, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
Occasionally a novel comes along that really catches my attention, and I first of all would like to thank Miriam Parker, Amanda Erickson, and the people at Little Brown for bringing this novel to my attention, because in the sea of novels that are published, this is a novel they sent to me, and they said, we really would like you to take a look at this because we think it's a special book.
That's great of them.
Yeah.
But no, they're doing their job.
Yeah, and that's... And that's nice. That's nice to see. And you know, and as an author, that's really what you need to get, you know, to get your work out front and center. And Michael, if you would, you wrote a novel, Martin Sloan, which was very critically well received. You've written a book of stories, Fidelity. You've written 4 books of poetry, and you're also a playwright and editor of a literary magazine. So if you would, why don't you tell the listeners here in the States a little bit about your background and your genesis as a writer and how you and your life up to writing Constellation, and then we'll talk about the particular book Constellation.
Sure. I was actually born in the States in 1966 to Canadian parents, and moved back to Toronto with them when I was still a baby, and I grew up in a part of Toronto called, at the time, Willowdale. It's now known as the City of North York. I grew up in a household of readers. I was exposed to books a lot as a child. I was read to a lot. So, you know, my interest in literature goes back all the way to childhood. In my teens, when I began to dabble, especially in poetry, I spent, as I imagine a lot of writers do in their formative years, just sort of trying out different voices and seeing what I was capable of and what I was attracted to as a writer. And for most of my early years as a writer, I wrote poetry. And I began as a published poet. I published, I think, 4 collections of poetry before I entertained the idea of writing fiction. Although in my teen years I wrote maybe 10 or 20 of the worst short stories ever committed to paper, and they're all locked in a vault in Geneva somewhere where they can't do me any harm. But I'd had, a stuttering apprenticeship in fiction as a writer, although I read quite widely as a young person in fiction. And then I had an idea for a novel that was inspired by and to some degree based on the work of Joseph Cornell, the American collage artist who I imagine many of your listeners might be familiar with. Especially in the last 10 years or so, Cornell has really come into his own. He was more sort of an art world phenomenon during his lifetime, but he's entered many of the most important art institutions in North America as well as the rest of the world. And I came across his work in Chicago in, I think it was probably 95 or 96, and was very attracted to the sort of quality of solitude that was present in his work, and the strange way of diarizing the inner life in 3 dimensions. And not all artists who work in sculpture-like mediums are necessarily as personal as Cornell was, but there was something very coded in Cornell's work that, to my imagination, lent itself to narrative. And so out of a fascination with Cornell's work, I began to sort of sculpt at first was a collage novel, through a course of many drafts and many years, turned into a narrative about a missing artist and the woman who searches for him after he's vanished. The novel met with some good success here in Canada as well as abroad. And around that time, I was beginning to also work in the theater here in Toronto. And it seems to, in general, has become a rule in my life, and not not a hard and fast rule, but something that's happened through experience, that I become attracted to things that I've seen examples of that really have moved me in some way. So, you know, I ended up getting involved in the theater here because I was excited by the ferment of activity that was going on at the grassroots in Toronto and wanted to be a part of it. And so that's sort of how the various levels of things came together and sort of happening all at the same time. And as for Brick, Brick is a literary journal that's been published out of Toronto for almost 30 years now. And friends of mine have been the editors since the mid-80s, Michael Ondaatje and Linda Spaulding.
Oh, wonderful.
And they asked me to come on and manage the magazine in 1998. So I've been with the magazine since then, and I actually bought the magazine from them in 2002, and I've been publishing it since, although everyone who was involved in the magazine before then is still involved. The editorial board hasn't changed, but just the ownership has.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And in Consolation, which, like I say, has just recently been published by Little Brown, I really thought it was a creative style of prose, because you go back and forth in time between Toronto in 1856 and then Toronto in 1997, and it's really fascinating. It's a look at history and how the city was built. And when I first started reading it, it seemed to me like they were very two separate and distinct stories. But as the story progressed, I realized that the stories were becoming very... the time element was losing its importance to me, and I realized how the concerns of 1856 and 1997 really were the same.
Yeah, well, I'm pleased that you take that out of the novel, because I think one of the sort of chief things that inspired me when I was writing the novel was the recognition that we have this illusory relationship with the past, in which we are able to tell ourselves that what came before us was very different, and we don't do things that way anymore. Our values have changed, our needs have changed, technology has made the world an easier and better place to live in, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, at their core, people always want the same things. They always lack the same things. Their fears and their hopes are very similar, not just from generation to generation, but from era to era. You know, all the way back to, you know, the earliest recorded history, you know, you realize that the things that drive people never change. So, you know, one thing that I wanted to talk about in this book was this, you know, illusory divide between, you know, now and then, however you define then, and that errant feeling of supremacy that so-called modern people feel about their forebears, or feel over their forebears, and how that leads to a kind of blindness about how to proceed in their daily lives. It's not so much a rejection of the past as it is a failure to recognize that there were reasons why things happened the way they did, and those reasons more than likely pertain to the way you're living your life now, and you ignore those things at your peril. And it's not, I don't think it's just as simple as that chestnut about, you know, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. I think that those who neglect the past are doomed to live in a sort of thin, ever-present where, you know, meaning is bundled up in immediate kinds of things that lack resonance. And our lives as moderns, I think, lack resonance at times because we're so focused on the here and now.
And one of the paragraphs that jumped out at me was, there's a reporter talking to Mary Ann, who's one of the characters in the 1997 section of the book, and the quote is, "He thought modern people were the loneliest people in the history of the world, and the thought that another time was under the one we live in was moving to him, because it's a kind of company for us, all of us marooned here in the present."
Yeah, that's pretty close to, that's very close to how I feel, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and when part of the story, the modern characters are David Hollis, who is a historian, who's looking for a series of glass negatives. He's married, his wife, and then he has a daughter, Mary Ann. And
no, sorry, his daughter's name is Bridget.
Well, Bridget, wife, I'm sorry, Mary Ann, and then Bridget is his daughter. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Mary Ann wants to prove that David had devoted a lot of his time to studying the history of this part of Toronto, and she wants to prove, there's a part of it that wants to prove that he's right, so kind of like that his life had meaning, and she goes to some fairly extreme measures to try to do this, and part of it is she's, you know, she's overcome with grief. But I like the way you used that as a way of, like, with progress, we really don't care what happened in the past, we'll just go blindly forward to pursue our modern goals.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that might be symptomatic of younger cities. You know, you can't imagine, you know, Parisians or Romans, you know, ripping out things of historical significance, the ground in their cities to put up condos. But we do it here because we're still in our adolescence as a city. We don't have enough perspective on what came before to value it enough to preserve it. And, you know, there are movements in this city as well as other Canadian cities where there are more, there's more will to fight for things of physical significance. I'm talking especially about our built legacy, you know, never mind about the natural legacy, which we're ripping out at a record pace anyway. But, you know, when you have a physical built legacy in a city, you have evidence of how people used to live. It takes time and the perspective that comes with time to be able to assign a value to these things. And so, you know, you look at the, you know, great, in quotes, cities of the world, and you see that there was a point in their own history where they woke up and they said, God, you know, we should probably take care of some of this stuff because it tells our story and it's going to be important to future generations. Our story will be incomplete without it. You know, but when Paris was 250 years old, were they busy, you know, labeling their cobblestones and, you know, putting historical plaques on their buildings? I don't think so. You know, Toronto is you know, less than 250 years old and is still in a phase of its history where there's a great deal of confusion. There's a profound confusion about what constitutes its legacy.
And the earlier the characters that take place in Toronto in 1856 and 1857 are Jem Hallam, Mrs. Rowe, and Mr. Enos, and they're all involved in the apothecary trade, or Mr. Hallam is, and then also with this new business which is evolving, which is ends up being photography. And talk, if you would, a little bit about that part of the story and the importance that it had to you as a novelist to set the stage for what you ultimately accomplish in the more modern part of the story.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, 1856 is a very interesting time, not just in the history of the city, but also in world history. It just happens to be serendipitous that, you know, in 1856, the technology of photography was right at a turning point where, before that date, it was mainly only possible to make what were called daguerreotypes, which were had a lot in common with portrait painting in a way, because you put a glass plate into a camera, you exposed it, and then you actually fixed the plate itself. The plate was the photograph. So you could only make one of them. And later on, there were tin types and amber types and so on and so forth, which were also one-off technologies. But around the mid-1850s, a process known as wet collodion was developed, whereby the glass plate was actually a negative, and you could pull paper positives off that glass plate and make as many as you wished. So for the first time in history, it was possible for the common person to have an image created of themselves. They could actually see what they looked like. And, you know, that was, I think, quite a signal moment in how people, you know, define their identities. You had mirrors, but you actually never looked, you never knew what you looked like to other people until photography came along. So this was happening in the mid-1850s. in 1856, Upper and Lower Canada, which were the, sort of the two bureaucratic divisions of the country, were allied into a single province called the Province of Canada, and this was 10 years before Confederation in this country. And Toronto was one of five cities that were vying to become the capital of this new province, and it was the only city of the five that thought to make a photographic portrait of itself. And lastly, 1856 was the very first international banking crisis. So when Hallam comes to Toronto, he comes at a particularly bad time, because this dark financial cloud is about to descend on the entire planet, but especially in the New World, in North America. It was very hard to get a foothold if you weren't financially secure already. So this is part of the background to why, among apothecaries, for instance, in Toronto, there's so much competition, and why Hallam, when he sets up shop, finds himself so unwelcome, because there's, of course, already druggists in Toronto, and they're not interested in sharing their territory with him. So all of these various elements conspire to throw these three people together. Claudia Rowe, who's a widow, and is, you know, lost in a world of men, basically. And Samuel Ennis, who's a photographer in a bad part of town, but happens to have a business that appeals to the vanity of people, even when, you know, money is short. And Jem Hallam, who's got a storefront full of chemicals that he can't sell because he's been forced out of business. So these three people sort of throw their fates together, and you know, the 1850s part of the novel tells their story.
And one of the things I like, and we won't give anything away because there's a nice payoff for the reader, but it's very easy to prejudge and misjudge some of the characters in the book, because it was just a different period of time that they lived in. And if we judge them by today's morality, we're liable to make some false assumptions.
Yes, I would think so, yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, there, naturally, one of the things that changes the most over time is, you know, social values and how people construct their moral universes and what the meaning of family is and what the meaning of obligation is. And these things are all given a good workout, I think, in the past part of the novel.
Mm-hmm. And the book we're discussing is Consolation, written by Michael Redhill, by Little Brown. I strongly recommend it if you're looking for a novel which is very creative. The characters are very well drawn and just a very creative prose style. And Michael, I'm wondering if I read where Goodness, which was a play that you wrote, won the Carol Tambor Award at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And tell us a little bit about your playwriting.
Sure. I've been sort of produced in Toronto on and off for the last 15 years or so as a playwright. And for me, playwriting is an opportunity to get out of my room, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Writing is solitary by its nature, even playwriting. But the opportunity once every few years to go work with a bunch of people in another room is very appealing for me. It rescues me from some of the isolation that comes with working on longer form prose, for instance. This play Goodness was commissioned by a sort of avant-garde theater company here in Toronto called Volcano Productions. And I had worked with the man who's the artistic director of that company, Ross Manson, once before on a play called Building Jerusalem, which is a play, sort of a historical Canadian play. And despite that description, actually did quite well. And Goodness came out of a collaboration that he and I started in about 2003. And the play had its premiere in Toronto last year, or 2005 now, I should say, and went to Edinburgh in the summer of 2006. And we were just kind of stunned by the reception it got there. It was, wildly positive. And then it won this award, which takes the form of a two-week run at PS 122 in New York City. So this will be the first time a play of mine has been in New York, and we have some high hopes. We know what we're up against down there, of course, but there's just a huge opportunity, not just for me in the play, but for the company. Volcano is widely regarded as one of the most important independent producers of new theater in Canada, and it's a huge showcase for Ross and his company as well.
Michael, when will that run take place? Okay, good.
It runs for 2 weeks.
Okay, well, we'll put that up on the website.
That's terrific.
And, Michael, with the combination of the different genres of writing you've done, and what is it with Consolation that you're happiest about as an author, that pulling together the poetry, the playwriting, the prose, the different characters, now that the book has finally seen the light of day, it's available in bookstores, online, what are you happiest about with what you've accomplished with Consolation?
Well, anytime you finish anything of any length, be it a poem or a play or a novel, you know, there's a sense that you've lived with something for quite a while, and letting go of it is pleasurable and worrisome all at once because it's no longer yours. But once you get some perspective on your work, you look back on it, and you ask yourself the question, regardless of its reception, about whether or not you accomplished what you set out to do, whether you've expressed the thing that you meant to express. And of course, there's a lot between the moment something occurs to you and when it's in its final form. And if you've managed to maintain some kernel of the origin of the thing in the first place, then that feels like a worthwhile journey to have taken. And you know, with Consolation, I wanted to write a book that would be in some ways an entry into what I hope would become a longer list of fictional works, not necessarily by me, but fictional works that use Toronto as a setting or a character. We have used, Toronto appears in a lot of very good or even great novels, including those by Michael Ondaatje and Margaret Atwood and other folks. But unlike other cities, we don't have a sort of spectrum of fictional approaches to the city, unlike Paris and London and New York, where in every era there's been, a voice out there that took the raw material of the city and the people who lived in it and, made stories out of it. And I think that's something that Toronto's sorely lacking. So it's something that I consciously set out to do when I wrote Consolation, was to make the city a place worthy of being mythologized on some level. So, and I think I've done that.
Yes, I think you have too. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time today. You've been listening to the Casey Coar Show, A Celebration of Words. We've been discussing Consolation by Michael Redhill. And Michael, congratulations on a very fine novel. And let's kind of pencil in that when the next book comes out, we'll get together and find out what you're doing. And I will post on the website when the play will be opening in New York. And best of luck with that.
Thanks very much for this. I appreciate it.